Evolution, let's take a closer look. In the frontal lobes of a monkey's brain, there are certain cells that fire when the monkey performs a very specific action. For instance, one cell fires during the pulling of a lever, a second for grabbing a peanut, a third for putting a peanut in the mouth, and yet a fourth for pushing something. Bear in mind, these neurons are part of a small circuit performing a highly specific task. A single neuron by itself doesn't move a hand, but its response allows you to eavesdrop on the circuit. Nothing new so far. Such motor command neurons were discovered by the renowned Johns Hopkins University neuroscientist Vernon Mountcastle several decades ago. While studying these motor command neurons in the late 1990s, another neuroscientist, Giacomo Rizzolatti, and his colleagues Giuseppe Di Pellegrino, Luciano Fadiga, and Vittorio Galis from the University of Parma in Italy noticed something very peculiar. Some of the neurons fired not only when the monkey performed an action, but also when it watched another monkey performing the same action. When I heard Rizzolatti deliver this news during a lecture one day, I nearly jumped off my seat. These were not mere motor command neurons. They were adopting the other animal's point of view, figure 4.1. These neurons, again, actually the neural circuit to which they belong. From now on, I'll use the word neuron for the circuit, were for all intents and purposes reading the other monkey's mind, figuring out what it was up to. This is an indispensable trait for intensely social creatures like primates. It isn't clear how exactly the mirror neuron is wired up to allow this predictive power. It is as if higher brain regions are reading the output from it and saying, in effect, the same neuron is now firing in my brain as would be firing as if I were reaching out for a banana. So the other monkey must be intending to reach for that banana now. It is as if mirror neurons are nature's own virtual reality simulations of the intentions of other beings. In monkeys, these mirror neurons enable the prediction of simple goal-directed actions of other monkeys. But in humans, and in humans alone, they have become sophisticated enough to interpret even complex intentions. How this increase in complexity took place will be hotly debated for some time to come. As we will see later, mirror neurons also enable you to imitate the movements of others, thereby setting the stage for the cultural inheritance of skills developed and honed by others. They may have also propelled a self-amplifying feedback loop that kicked in at one point to accelerate brain evolution in our species. As Rizzolatti noted, mirror neurons may also enable you to mime the lip and tongue movements of others, which in turn would provide the evolutionary basis for verbal utterances. Once these two abilities are in place, the ability to read someone's intentions and the ability to mimic their vocalizations, you have set in motion two of the many foundational events that shape the evolution of language. You need no longer speak of a unique language organ, and the problem doesn't seem quite so mysterious anymore. These arguments do not in any way negate the idea that there are specialized brain areas for language in humans. We are dealing here with the question of how such areas may have evolved, not whether they exist or not. An important piece of the puzzle is Rizzolatti's observation that one of the chief areas where mirror neurons abound, the central premotor area in monkeys, may be the precursor of our celebrated Broca's area, a brain center associated with the expressive aspects of human language. Language is not confined to any single brain area, but the left inferior parietal lobe is certainly one of the areas that are crucially involved, especially in the representation of word meaning. Not coincidentally, this area is also rich in mirror neurons in the monkey. But how do we actually know that mirror neurons exist in the human brain? It is one thing to saw open the skull of a monkey and spend days or weeks probing around with a microelectrode, but people do not seem interested in volunteering for such procedures. One unexpected hint comes from patients with a strange disorder called anosognosia, a condition in which people seem unaware of or deny their disability. Most patients with a right hemisphere stroke have complete paralysis of the left side of their body and, as you might expect, complain about it. But about 1 in 20 of them will vehemently deny their paralysis, even though they are mentally otherwise lucid and intelligent. For example, President Woodrow Wilson, whose left side was paralyzed by a stroke in 1919, insisted that he was perfectly fine. Despite the clouding of his thought processes, and against all advice, he remained in office, making elaborate travel plans and major decisions pertaining to American involvement in the League of Nations. In 1996, some colleagues and I made our own little investigation of anosognosia and noticed something new and amazing. Some of these patients not only denied their own paralysis, but also denied the paralysis of another patient. And let me assure you, the second patient's inability to move was as clear as day. Denying one's own paralysis is odd enough, but why deny another patient's paralysis? We suggest that this bizarre observation is best understood in terms of damage to Rizzolatti's mirror neurons. It's as if any time you want to make a judgment about someone else's movements, you have to run a virtual reality simulation of the corresponding movements in your own brain. And without mirror neurons, you cannot do this. The second piece of evidence for mirror neurons in humans comes from studying certain brain waves in humans. When people perform volitional actions with their hands, the so-called mu wave disappears completely. My colleagues Eric Altshuler, Jamie Pineda, and I found that mu wave suppression also occurs when a person watches someone else moving his hand, but not if he watches a similar movement by an inanimate object, such as a ball bouncing up and down. We suggested at the Society for Neuroscience meeting in 1998 that this suppression was caused by Rizzolatti's mirror neuron system. Since Rizzolatti's discovery, other types of mirror neurons have been found. Researchers at the University of Toronto were recording from cells in the anterior cingulate in conscious patients who were undergoing neurosurgery. Neurons in this area have long been known to respond to physical pain. On the assumption that such neurons respond to pain receptors in the skin, they are often called sensory pain neurons. Imagine the head surgeon's astonishment when he found that the sensory pain neuron he was monitoring responded equally vigorously when the patient watched another patient being poked. It was as though the neuron was empathizing with someone else. Neuroimaging experiments on human volunteers conducted by Tanya Singer also supported this conclusion. I like calling these cells Gandhi neurons because they blur the boundary between self and others, not just metaphorically, but quite literally, since the neuron can't tell the difference. Similar neurons for touch have since been discovered in the parietal lobe by a group headed by Christian Kaisers using brain imaging techniques. Think of what this means. Anytime you watch someone doing something, the neurons that your brain would use to do the same thing become active, as if you yourself were doing it. If you see a person being poked with a needle, your pain neurons fire away as though you were being poked. It is utterly fascinating, and it raises some interesting questions. What prevents you from blindly imitating every action you see, or from literally feeling someone else's pain? In the case of motor mirror neurons, one answer is that there may be frontal inhibitory circuits that suppress the automatic mimicry when it is inappropriate. In a delicious paradox, this need to inhibit unwanted or impulsive actions may have been a major reason for the evolution of free will. Your left inferior parietal lobe constantly conjures up vivid images of multiple options for action that are available in any given context, and your frontal cortex suppresses all but one of them. Thus, it has been suggested that free won't may be a better term than free will. When these frontal inhibitory circuits are damaged, as in frontal lobe syndrome, the patient sometimes mimics gestures uncontrollably, a symptom called echopraxia. I would predict, too, that some of these patients might literally experience pain if you poke someone else, but to my knowledge, this has never been looked for. Some degree of leakage from the mirror neuron system can occur even in normal individuals. Charles Darwin pointed out that, even as adults, we feel ourselves unconsciously flexing our knee when watching an athlete getting ready to throw a javelin, and clench and unclench our jaws when we watch someone using a pair of scissors. Turning now to the sensory mirror neurons for touch and pain, why doesn't their firing automatically make us feel everything we witness? It occurred to me that perhaps the null signal, "I am not being touched," from skin and joint receptors in your own hand, block the signals from your mirror neurons from reaching conscious awareness. The overlapping presence of the null signals and the mirror neuron activity is interpreted by higher brain centers to mean, empathize by all means, but don't literally feel that other guy's sensations. Speaking in more general terms, it is the dynamic interplay of signals from frontal inhibitory circuits, mirror neurons, both frontal and parietal, and null signals from receptors that allow you to enjoy reciprocity with others while simultaneously preserving your individuality. At first, this explanation was an idle speculation on my part, but then I met a patient named Humphrey. Humphrey had lost his hand in the first Gulf War and now had a phantom hand. As is true in other patients, whenever he was touched on his face, he felt sensations in his missing hand. No surprises so far. But with ideas about mirror neurons brewing in my mind, I decided to try a new experiment. I simply had him watch another person, my student Julie, while I stroked and tapped her hand. Imagine our amazement when he exclaimed with considerable surprise that he could not merely see, but actually feel the things being done to Julie's hand on his phantom. I suggest this happens because his mirror neurons were being activated in the normal fashion, but there was no longer a null signal from the hand to veto them. Humphrey's mirror neuron activity was emerging fully into conscious experience. Imagine, the only thing separating your consciousness from another's might be your skin. After seeing this phenomenon in Humphrey, we tested three other patients and found the same effect, which we dubbed acquired hyperempathy. Amazingly, it turns out that some of these patients get relief from phantom limb pain by merely watching another person being massaged. This might prove useful clinically because, obviously, you can't directly massage a phantom. These surprising results raise another fascinating question. Instead of amputation, what if a patient's brachial plexus, the nerves connecting the arm to the spinal cord, were to be anesthetized? Would the patient then experience touch sensations in his anesthetized hand when merely watching an accomplice being touched? The surprising answer is yes. This result has radical implications, for it suggests that no major structural reorganization in the brain is required for the hyperempathy effect. Merely numbing the arm is adequate. I did this experiment with my student, Laura Case. Once again, the picture that emerges is a much more dynamic view of brain connections than what you would be led to believe from the static picture implied by textbook diagrams. Sure enough, brains are made up of modules, but the modules are not fixed entities. They are constantly being updated through powerful interactions with each other, with the body, the environment, and indeed, with other brains. Many new questions have emerged since mirror neurons were discovered. First, are mirror neuron functions present innately, or learned, or perhaps a little of both? Second, how are mirror neurons wired up, and how do they perform their functions? Third, why did they evolve, if they did? Fourth, do they serve any purpose beyond the obvious one for which they were named? I will argue that they do. I have already hinted at possible answers, but let me expand. One skeptical view of mirror neurons is that they are just a result of associative learning, as when a dog salivates in anticipation of dinner when she hears her master's key in the front door lock each evening. The argument is that every time a monkey moves his hand toward the peanut, not only does the peanut-grabbing command neuron fire, but so does the visual neuron that is activated by the appearance of his own hand reaching for a peanut. Since neurons that fire together wire together, as the old mnemonic goes, eventually even the mere sight of a moving hand, its own or another monkey's, triggers a response from the command neurons. But if this is the correct explanation, why do only a subset of the command neurons fire? Why aren't all the command neurons for this action mirror neurons? Furthermore, the visual appearance of another person reaching toward a peanut is very different from your view of your own hand. So how does the mirror neuron apply the appropriate correction for vantage point? No simple, straightforward associationist model can account for this. And finally, so what if learning plays a role in constructing mirror neurons? Even if it does, that doesn't make them any less interesting or important for understanding brain function. The question of what mirror neurons are doing and how they work is quite independent of the question of whether they are wired up by genes or by the environment. Highly relevant to this discussion is an important discovery made by Andrew Meltzoff, a cognitive psychologist at the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences in Seattle. He found that a newborn infant will often protrude its tongue when watching its mother do it. And when I say newborn, I mean it, just a few hours old. The neural circuitry involved must be hardwired and not based on associative learning. The child's smile, echoing the mother's smile, appears a little later, but again, it can't be based on learning, since the baby can't see its own face. It has to be innate. It has not been proven whether mirror neurons are responsible for these earliest imitative behaviors, but it's a fair bet. The ability would depend on mapping the visual appearance of the mother's protruding tongue or smile onto the child's own motor maps, controlling a finely adjusted sequence of facial muscle twitches. As I noted in my BBC Radio Reith Lectures in 2003, entitled The Emerging Mind, this sort of translation between maps is precisely what mirror neurons are thought to do, and if this ability is innate, it is truly astonishing. I'll call it the sexy version of the mirror neuron function. Some people argue that the complex computational ability for true imitation, based on mirror neurons, emerges only later in development, whereas the tongue protrusion and first smile are merely hardwired reflexes in response to simple triggers from mom, the same way a cat's claws come out when it sees a dog. The only way to distinguish the sexy from the mundane explanation would be to see whether a baby can imitate a non-stereotyped movement it is unlikely to ever encounter in nature, such as an asymmetrical smile, a wink, or a curious distortion of the mouth. This couldn't be done by a simple hardwired reflex. The experiment would settle the issue once and for all. Independent of the question of whether mirror neurons are innate or acquired, let us now take a closer look at what they actually do. Many functions were proposed when they were first reported, and I'd like to build on these earlier speculations. Let's make a list of things they might be doing. Bear in mind, they may have originally evolved for purposes other than the ones listed here. These secondary functions may simply be a bonus, but that doesn't make them any less useful. First, and most obvious, they allow you to figure out someone else's intentions. When you see your friend Josh's hand moves toward the ball, your own ball-reaching neurons start firing. By running this virtual simulation of being Josh, you get the immediate impression that he is intending to reach for the ball. This ability to entertain a theory of mind may exist in the great apes in rudimentary form, but we humans are exceptionally good at it. Second, in addition to allowing us to see the world from another person's visual vantage point, mirror neurons may have evolved further, enabling us to adopt the other person's conceptual vantage point. It may not be entirely coincidental that we use metaphors like, "I see what you mean," or "try to see it from my point of view." How this magic step from literal to conceptual viewpoint occurred in evolution, if indeed it occurred, is of fundamental importance, but it is not an easy proposition to test experimentally. As a corollary to adopting the other's point of view, you can also see yourself as others see you, an essential ingredient of self-awareness. This is seen in common language. When we speak of someone being self-conscious, what we really mean is that she is conscious of someone else being conscious of her. Much the same can be said for a word like self-pity. I will return to this idea in the concluding chapter on consciousness and mental illness. There I will argue that other awareness and self-awareness co-evolved in tandem, leading to the IU reciprocity that characterizes humans. A less obvious function of mirror neurons is abstraction, again, something humans are especially good at. This is well illuminated by the Buba-Kiki experiment discussed in Chapter 3 in the context of synesthesia. To reiterate, over 95% of people identify the jagged form as the Kiki and the curvy one as Buba. The explanation I gave is that the sharp inflections of the jagged shape mimic the inflection of the sound, Kiki, not to mention the sudden deflection of the tongue from the palate. The gentle curves of bulbous shape, on the other hand, mimic the boo-ba contour of the sound and the tongue's undulation on the palate. Similarly, the sound sh, as in shall, is linked to a blurred, smudged line, whereas rr is linked to a sawtooth-shaped line, and a s, as in sip, to a fine silk thread, which shows that it's not the mere similarity of the jagged shape to the letter K that produces the effect, but genuine cross-sensory abstraction. The link between the Buba-Kiki effect and mirror neurons may not be immediately evident, but there is a fundamental similarity. The main computation done by mirror neurons is to transform a map in one dimension, such as the visual appearance of someone else's movement, into another dimension, such as the motor maps in the observer's brain, which contain programs for muscle movements, including tongue and lip movements. This is exactly what's going on in the Buba-Kiki effect. Your brain is performing an impressive feat of abstraction in linking your visual and auditory maps. The two inputs are entirely dissimilar in every way except one, the abstract properties of jaggedness or curviness, and your brain homes in on this common denominator very swiftly when you are asked to pair them up. I call this process cross-modal abstraction. This ability to compute similarities despite surface differences may have paved the way for more complex types of abstraction that our species takes great delight in. Mirror neurons may be the evolutionary conduit that allowed this to happen. Why did a seemingly esoteric ability like cross-modal abstraction evolve in the first place? As I suggested in a previous chapter, it may have emerged in ancestral arboreal primates to allow them to negotiate and grasp tree branches. The vertical visual inputs of tree limbs and branches reaching the eye had to be matched with totally dissimilar inputs from joints and muscles and the body's felt sense of where it was in space, an ability that would have favored the development of both canonical neurons and mirror neurons. The readjustments that were required in order to establish a congruence between sensory and motor maps may have initially been based on feedback, both at the genetic level of the species and at the experiential level of the individual. But once the rules of congruence were in place, the cross-modal abstraction would occur for novel inputs. For instance, picking up a shape that is visually perceived to be tiny would result in a spontaneous movement of almost opposed thumb and forefingers, and if this were mimicked by the lips to produce a correspondingly diminutive orifice through which you blow air, you would produce sounds, words, that sound small, such as teeny-weeny, diminutive, or in French, un peu, and so on. These small sounds would in turn feed back via the ears to be linked to tiny shapes. This, as we shall see in Chapter 6, may have been how the first words evolved in our ancestral hominins. The resulting three-way resonance between vision, touch, and hearing may have progressively amplified itself as in an echo chamber, culminating in the full-fledged sophistication of cross-sensory and other more complex types of abstraction. If this formulation is correct, some aspects of mirror neuron function may indeed be acquired through learning, building on a genetically specified scaffolding unique to humans. Of course, many monkeys and even lower vertebrates may have mirror neurons, but the neurons may need to develop a certain minimum sophistication and number of connections with other brain areas before they can engage in the kinds of abstractions that humans are good at. What parts of the brain are involved in such abstractions? I already hinted, about language, that the inferior parietal lobule, IPL, may have played a pivotal role, but let's take a closer look. In lower mammals, the IPL isn't very large, but it becomes more conspicuous in primates. Even within primates, it is disproportionately large in the great apes, reaching a climax in humans. Finally, only in humans do we see a major portion of this lobule splitting further into two, the angular gyrus and the supramarginal gyrus, suggesting that something important was going on in this region of the brain during human evolution. Lying at the crossroads between vision, occipital lobes, touch, parietal lobes, and hearing, temporal lobes, the IPL is strategically located to receive information from all sensory modalities. At a fundamental level, cross-modal abstraction involves the dissolution of barriers to create modality-free representations, as exemplified by the Buba-Kiki effect. The evidence for this is that when we tested three patients who had damage to the left angular gyrus, they performed poorly on the Buba-Kiki task. As I already noted, this ability to map one dimension onto another is one of the things that mirror neurons are thought to be doing, and not coincidentally, such neurons are plentiful in the general vicinity of the IPL. The fact that this region in the human brain is disproportionately large and differentiated suggests an evolutionary leap. The upper part of the IPL, the supramarginal gyrus, is another structure unique to humans. Damage here leads to a disorder called idiomotor apraxia, a failure to perform skilled actions in response to the doctor's commands. Asked to pretend he is combing his hair, an apraxic will raise his arm, look at it, and flail it around his head. Asked to mime hammering a nail, he will make a fist and bang it on the table. This happens even though his hand isn't paralyzed. He will spontaneously scratch an itch, and he knows what combing means. It means I'm using a comb to tidy up my hair, doctor. What he lacks is the ability to conjure up a mental picture of the required action, in this case combing, which must precede and orchestrate the actual execution of the action. These are functions one would normally associate with mirror neurons, and indeed, the supramarginal gyrus has mirror neurons. If our speculations are on the right track, then one would expect patients with apraxia to be terrible at understanding and imitating other people's movements. Although we have seen some hints of this, the matter requires careful investigation. One also wonders about the evolutionary origin of metaphors. Once the cross-modal abstraction mechanism was set up between vision and touch in the IPL, originally for grasping branches, this mechanism could have paved the way for cross-sensory metaphors, stinging rebuke, loud shirt, and eventually for metaphors in general. This is supported by our recent observations that patients with angular gyrus lesions not only have difficulty with Buba-Kiki, but also with understanding simple proverbs, interpreting them literally rather than metaphorically. Obviously, these observations need to be confirmed on a larger sample of patients. It is easy to imagine how cross-modal abstraction might work for Buba Kiki, but how do you explain metaphors that combine very abstract concepts like "it is the East and Juliet is the Sun," given the seemingly infinite number of such concepts in the brain? The surprising answer to this question is that the number of concepts is not infinite, nor is the number of words that represent them. For all practical purposes, most English speakers have a vocabulary of about 10,000 words, although you can get by with far fewer if you are a surfer. There may be only some mappings that make sense. As the eminent cognitive scientist and polymath Jerron Lanier pointed out to me, Juliet can be the sun, but it makes little sense to say she is a stone or an orange juice carton. Bear in mind that the metaphors that get repeated and become immortal are the apt ones, the resonant ones. In doggerel, comically bad metaphors abound. Mirror neurons play another important role in the uniqueness of the human condition. They allow us to imitate. You already know about tongue protrusion mimicry in infants, but once we reach a certain age, we can mime very complex motor skills, such as your mom's baseball swing or a thumbs-up gesture. No ape can match our imitative talents. However, I will note as an interesting aside here, the ape that comes closest to us in this regard is not our nearest cousin, the chimpanzee, but the orangutan. Orangutans can even open locks or use an oar to row once they have seen someone else do it. They are also the most arboreal and prehensile of the great apes, so their brains may be jam-packed with mirror neurons for allowing their babies to watch mom in order to learn how to negotiate trees without the penalties of trial and error. If, by some miracle, an isolated pocket of orangs in Borneo survives the environmental holocaust that Homo sapiens seems hell-bent on bringing about, these meek apes may well inherit the earth. Miming may not seem like an important skill. After all, aping someone is a derogatory term, which is ironic given that most apes are actually not very good at imitation. But as I have previously argued, miming may have been the key step in hominin evolution, resulting in our ability to transmit knowledge through example. When this step was taken, our species suddenly made the transition from gene-based Darwinian evolution through natural selection, which can take millions of years, to cultural evolution. A complex skill, initially acquired through trial and error, or by accident, as when some ancestral hominid first saw a shrub catching fire from lava, could be transmitted rapidly to every member of a tribe, both young and old. Other researchers, including Merlin Donald, have made the same point, although not in relation to mirror neurons.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
This liberation from the constraints of a strictly gene-based Darwinian evolution was a giant step in human evolution. One of the big puzzles in human evolution is what we earlier referred to as the Great Leap Forward, the relatively sudden emergence between 60,000 and 100,000 years ago of a number of traits we regard as uniquely human: fire, art, constructed shelters, body adornment, multi-component tools, and more complex use of language. Anthropologists often assume this explosive development of cultural sophistication must have resulted from a set of new mutations affecting the brain in equally complex ways. But that doesn't explain why all of these marvelous abilities should have emerged at roughly the same time. One possible explanation is that the so-called Great Leap is just a statistical illusion. The arrival of these traits may in fact have been smeared out over a much longer period of time than the physical evidence depicts. But surely the traits don't have to emerge at exactly the same time for the question to still be valid. Even spread out, 30,000 years is just a blip compared to the millions of years of small, gradual behavioral changes that took place prior to that. A second possibility is that the new brain mutations simply increased our general intelligence, the capacity for abstract reasoning as measured by IQ tests. This idea is on the right track, but it doesn't tell us much, even leaving aside the very legitimate criticism that intelligence is a complex, multifaceted ability which can't be meaningfully averaged into a single, general ability. That leaves a third possibility, one that brings us back full circle to mirror neurons. I suggest that there was indeed a genetic change in the brain, but ironically, the change freed us from genetics by enhancing our ability to learn from one another. This unique ability liberated our brain from its Darwinian shackles, allowing the rapid spread of unique inventions, such as making cowrie shell necklaces, using fire, constructing tools and shelter, or indeed even inventing new words. After 6 billion years of evolution, culture finally took off, and with culture, the seeds of civilization were sown. The advantage of this argument is that you don't need to postulate separate mutations arriving nearly simultaneously to account for the co-emergence of our many and various unique mental abilities. Instead, increased sophistication of a single mechanism, such as imitation and intention reading, could explain the huge behavioral gap between us and apes. I'll illustrate with an analogy. Imagine a Martian naturalist watching human evolution over the last 500,000 years. She would, of course, be puzzled by the great leap forward that occurred 50,000 years ago, but would be even more puzzled by a second great leap which occurred between 500 BCE and the present. Thanks to certain innovations, such as those in mathematics, in particular the zero, place value, and numerical symbols in India in the first millennium BCE, and geometry in Greece during the same period, and more recently in experimental science by Galileo, the behavior of a modern civilized person is vastly more complex than that of humans 10,000 to 50,000 years ago. This second leap forward in culture was even more dramatic than the first. There is a greater behavioral gap between pre- and post-500 BCE humans than between, say, Homo erectus and early Homo sapiens. Our Martian scientist might conclude that a new set of mutations made this possible. Yet, given the timescale, that's just not possible. The revolution stemmed from a set of purely environmental factors which happened fortuitously at the same time. Let's not forget the invention of the printing press, which allowed the extraordinary spread and near universal availability of knowledge that usually remained confined to the elite. But if we admit this, then why doesn't the same argument apply to the first great leap? Maybe there was a lucky set of environmental circumstances and a few accidental inventions by a gifted few which could tap into a pre-existing ability to learn and propagate information quickly, the basis of culture. And in case you haven't guessed by now, that ability might hinge on a sophisticated mirror neuron system. A caveat is in order. I am not arguing that mirror neurons are sufficient for the Great Leap or for culture in general. I'm only saying that they played a crucial role. Someone has to discover or invent something, like noticing the spark when two rocks are struck together, before the discovery can spread. My argument is that even if such accidental innovations were hit upon by chance by individual early hominins, they would have fizzled out were it not for a sophisticated mirror neuron system. After all, even monkeys have mirror neurons, but they are not the bearers of a proud culture. Their mirror neuron system is either not advanced enough or is not adequately connected to other brain structures to allow the rapid propagation of culture. Furthermore, once the propagation mechanism was in place, it would have exerted selective pressure to make some outliers in the population more innovative. This is because innovations would only be valuable if they spread rapidly. In this respect, we could say mirror neurons served the same role in early hominin evolution as the internet Wikipedia, and blogging do today. Once the cascade was set in motion, there was no turning back from the path to humanity. Chapter 5. Where is Stephen? The Riddle of Autism. You must always be puzzled by mental illness. The thing I would dread most, if I became mentally ill, would be your adopting a common-sense attitude, that you would take it for granted that I was deluded. Ludwig Wittgenstein. I know Stephen is trapped in there somewhere, Dr. Ramachandran. If only you could find a way to tell our son how dearly we love him, perhaps you could bring him out. How often have physicians heard that heartbreaking lament from parents of children with autism? This devastating developmental disorder was discovered independently by two physicians, Leo Kanner in Baltimore and Hans Asperger in Vienna, in the 1940s. Neither doctor had any knowledge of the other, and yet by an uncanny coincidence, they gave the syndrome the same name, autism. The word comes from the Greek autos, meaning self, a perfect description because the most striking feature of autism is a complete withdrawal from the social world and a marked reluctance or inability to interact with people. Take Stephen, for instance. He is 6 years old, with freckled cheeks and sandy brown hair. He is sitting at a play table drawing pictures, his brow lightly furrowed in concentration. He is producing some beautiful drawings of animals. There's one of a galloping horse that is so wonderfully animated that it seems to leap out of the paper. You might be tempted to walk over and praise him for his talent. The possibility that he might be profoundly incapacitated would never cross your mind. But the moment you try to talk to him, you realize that there's a sense in which Stephen the person simply isn't there. He is incapable of anything remotely resembling the two-way exchange of normal conversation. He refuses to make eye contact. Your attempts to engage him make him extremely anxious. He fidgets and rocks his body to and fro. All attempts to communicate with him meaningfully have been, and will be, in vain. Since the time of Kanner and Asperger, there have been hundreds of case studies in the medical literature documenting in detail the various seemingly unrelated symptoms that characterize autism. These fall into two major groups, social cognitive and sensory motor. In the first group, we have the single most important diagnostic symptom, mental aloneness and a lack of contact with the world, particularly the social world, as well as a profound inability to engage in normal conversation. Going hand in hand with this is an absence of emotional empathy for others. Even more surprising, autistic children express no outward sense of play, and they do not engage in the untrammeled make-believe with which normal children fill their waking hours. Humans, it has been pointed out, are the only animals that carry our sense of whimsy and playfulness into adulthood. How sad it must be for parents to see their autistic sons and daughters impervious to the enchantment of childhood. Yet, despite this social withdrawal, autistic children have a heightened interest in their inanimate surroundings, often to the point of being obsessive. This can lead to the emergence of odd, narrow preoccupations and a fascination with things that seem utterly trivial to most of us, like memorizing all the phone numbers in a directory. Let us turn now to the second cluster of symptoms, sensory motor. On the sensory side, autistic children may find specific sensory stimuli highly distressing. Certain sounds, for example, can set off a violent temper tantrum. There is also a fear of novelty and change, and an obsessive insistence on sameness, routine, and monotony. The motor symptoms include a to-and-fro rocking of the body, such as we saw with Stephen, repetitive hand movements, including flapping motions and self-slapping, and sometimes elaborate repetitive rituals. These sensory motor symptoms are not quite as definitive or as devastating as the social-emotional ones, but they co-occur so frequently that they must be connected somehow. Our picture of what causes autism would be incomplete if we failed to account for them. There is one more motor symptom to mention, one that I think holds the key to unraveling the mystery. Many autistic children have difficulty with miming and imitating other people's actions. This simple observation suggested to me a deficiency in the mirror neuron system. Much of the remainder of this chapter chronicles my pursuit of this hypothesis and the fruit it has borne so far. Not surprisingly, there have been dozens of theories of what causes autism. These can be broadly divided into psychological explanations and physiological explanations, the latter emphasizing innate abnormalities in brain wiring or neurochemistry. One ingenious psychological explanation, put forward by Uta Frith of University College of London and Simon Baron Cohen of Cambridge University, is the notion that children with autism have a deficient theory of other minds. Less credible is the psychodynamic view that blames bad parenting, an idea that is so absurd that I won't consider it further. We encountered the term theory of mind in passing in the previous chapter in relation to apes. Now let me explain it more fully. It is a technical term that is widely used in the cognitive sciences, from philosophy to primatology to clinical psychology. It refers to your ability to attribute intelligent mental beingness to other people, to understand that your fellow humans behave the way they do because, you assume, they have thoughts, emotions, ideas, and motivations of more or less the same kind as you yourself possess. In other words, even though you cannot actually feel what it is like to be another individual, you use your theory of mind to automatically project intentions, perceptions, and beliefs into the minds of others. In so doing, you are able to infer their feelings and intentions and to predict and influence their behavior. Calling it a theory can be a little misleading, since the word theory is normally used to refer to an intellectual system of statements and predictions, rather than in this sense, where it refers to an innate, intuitive mental faculty. But that is the term my field uses, so that is the term I will use here. Most people do not appreciate just how complex and frankly miraculous it is that they possess a theory of mind. It seems as natural, as immediate, and as simple as looking and seeing. But as we saw in Chapter 2, the ability to see is actually a very complicated process that engages a widespread network of brain regions. Our species' highly sophisticated theory of mind is one of the most unique and powerful faculties of the human brain. Our theory of mind ability apparently does not rely on our general intelligence, the rational intelligence you use to reason, to draw inferences, to combine facts, and so forth, but on a specialized set of brain mechanisms that evolved to endow us with our equally important degree of social intelligence. The idea that there might be specialized circuitry for social cognition was first suggested by psychologist Nick Humphrey and primatologist David Primack in the 1970s, and it now has a great deal of empirical support. So Frith's hunch about autism and theory of mind was compelling. Perhaps autistic children's profound deficits in social interactions stem from their theory of mind circuitry being somehow compromised. This idea is undoubtedly on the right track, but if you think about it, saying that autistic children cannot interact socially because they have a deficient theory of mind doesn't go very far beyond restating the observed symptoms. It's a good starting point, but what is really needed is to identify brain systems whose known functions match those that are deranged in autism. Many brain imaging studies have been conducted on children with autism, some pioneered by Eric Corshane. It has been noted, for example, that children with autism have larger brains with enlarged ventricles, cavities in the brain. The same group of researchers has also noted striking changes in the cerebellum. These are intriguing observations that will surely have to be accounted for when we have a clearer understanding of autism. But they do not explain the symptoms that characterize the disorder. In children with damage to the cerebellum due to other organic diseases, one sees very characteristic symptoms, such as intention tremor, when the patient attempts to touch his nose, The hand begins to oscillate wildly. Nystagmus, jerky eye movements, and ataxia, swaggering gait. None of these symptoms are typical of autism. Conversely, symptoms typical of autism, such as lack of empathy and social skills, are never seen in cerebellar disease. One reason for this might be that the cerebellar changes observed in autistic children may be the unrelated side effects of abnormal genes whose other effects are the true causes of autism. If so, what might these other effects be? What's needed, if we wish to explain autism, is candidate neural structures in the brain whose specific functions precisely match the particular symptoms that are unique to autism. The clue comes from mirror neurons. In the late 1990s, it occurred to my colleagues and me that these neurons provided precisely the candidate neural mechanism we were looking for. You can refer back to the previous chapter if you want a refresher, but suffice it to say, the discovery of mirror neurons was significant because they are essentially a network of mind-reading cells within the brain. They provided the missing physiological basis for certain high-level abilities that had long been challenging for neuroscientists to explain. We were struck by the fact that it is precisely these presumed functions of mirror neurons, such as empathy, intention reading, mimicry, pretend play, and language learning, that are dysfunctional in autism. All of these activities require adopting the other's point of view, even if the other is imaginary, as in pretend play or enjoying action figures. You can make two columns side by side, one for the known characteristics of mirror neurons and one for the clinical symptoms of autism, and there is an almost precise match. It seemed reasonable, therefore, to suggest that the main cause of autism is a dysfunctional mirror neuron system. The hypothesis has the advantage of explaining many seemingly unrelated symptoms in terms of a single cause. It might seem quixotic to suppose that there could be a single cause behind such a complex disorder, but we have to bear in mind that multiple effects do not necessarily imply multiple causes. Consider diabetes. Its manifestations are numerous and varied. Polyuria, excessive urination, polydipsia, incessant thirst, polyphagia, increased appetite, weight loss, kidney disorders, ocular changes, nerve damage, gangrene, plus quite a few others. But underlying this miscellany is something relatively simple, either insulin deficiency or fewer insulin receptors on cell surfaces. Of course, the disease is not simple at all. There are a lot of complex ins and outs. There are numerous environmental, genetic, and behavioral effects in play. But in the big picture, it comes down to insulin or insulin receptors. Analogously, our suggestion was that in the big picture, the main cause of autism is a disturbed mirror neuron system. Andrew Whitten's group in Scotland made this proposal at about the same time ours did, but the first experimental evidence for it came from our lab working in collaboration with researchers Eric Altshuler and Jamie Pineda here at UC San Diego. We needed a way to eavesdrop on mirror neuron activity non-invasively without opening the children's skulls and inserting electrodes. Fortunately, we found there was an easy way to do this using EEG, electroencephalography, which uses a grid of electrodes placed on the scalp to pick up brain waves. Long before CT scans and MRIs, EEG was the very first brain imaging technology invented by humans. It was pioneered in the early 20th century and has been in clinical use since the 1940s. As the brain hums along in various states, awake, asleep, alert, drowsy, daydreaming, focused, and so on, it generates telltale patterns of electrical brain waves at different frequencies. It has been known for over half a century that, as mentioned in Chapter 4, one particular brain wave, the mu wave, is suppressed any time a person makes a volitional movement, even a simple movement like opening and closing the fingers. It was subsequently discovered that mu wave suppression also occurs when a person watches another person performing the same movement. We therefore suggested that mu wave suppression might provide a simple, inexpensive, and non-invasive probe for monitoring mirror neuron activity. We ran a pilot experiment with a medium-functioning autistic child, Justin, to see if it would work. Very young, low-functioning children did not participate in this pilot study, as we wanted to confirm that any difference between normal and autistic mirror neuron activity that we found was not due to problems in attention, understanding instructions, or a general effect of mental retardation. Justin had been referred to us by a local support group created to promote the welfare of local children with autism. Like Stephen, he displayed many of the characteristic symptoms of autism, but was able to follow simple instructions, such as look at the screen, and was not reluctant to have electrodes placed on his scalp. As in normal children, Justin exhibited a robust mu wave while he sat around idly, and the mu wave was suppressed when we asked him to make simple voluntary movements. But remarkably, when he watched someone else perform the action, the suppression did not occur as it ought to. This observation provided a striking vindication of our hypothesis. We concluded that the child's motor command system was intact. He could, after all, open doors, eat potato chips, draw pictures, climb stairs, and so on, but his mirror neuron system was deficient. We presented this single subject case study at the 2000 annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience, and we followed it up with 10 additional children in 2004. Our results were identical. This observation has since received extensive confirmation over the years from many different groups using a variety of techniques. For example, a group of researchers led by Rita Hari at the Aalto University of Science and Technology corroborated our conjecture using MEG, magnetoencephalography, which is to EEG what jets are to biplanes. More recently, Michelle Villalobos and her colleagues at San Diego State University used fMRI to show a reduction in functional connectivity between the visual cortex and the prefrontal mirror neuron region in autistic patients. Other researchers have tested our hypothesis using TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. TMS is, in one sense, the opposite of EEG. Rather than passively eavesdropping on the electrical signals emanating from the brain, TMS creates electrical currents in the brain using a powerful magnet held over the scalp. Thus, with TMS, you can induce neural activity artificially in any brain region that happens to be near the scalp. Unfortunately, many brain regions are tucked away in the brain's deep folds, but plenty of other regions, including the motor cortex, are conveniently located directly beneath the skull, where TMS can zap them easily. The researchers used TMS to stimulate the motor cortex, then recorded electromuscular activation while the subjects watched other people performing actions. When a normal subject watches another person performing an action, say squeezing a tennis ball with the right hand, the muscles in the subject's own right hand will register a tiny uptick in their electrical chatter. Even though the subject doesn't perform a squeezing action herself, the mere act of watching the action leads to a tiny but measurable increase in the action readiness of the muscles that would contract if she were performing it. The subject's own motor system automatically simulates the perceived action, but at the same time, it automatically suppresses the spinal motor signal to prevent it from being carried out, and yet a tiny trickle of the suppressed motor command still manages to leak through and down to reach the muscles. That's what happens in normal subjects, but the autistic subjects showed no sign of increased muscle potentials while watching actions being performed. Their mirror neurons were missing in action. These results, taken together with our own, provide conclusive evidence that the hypothesis is correct. The mirror neuron hypothesis can explain several of the more quirky manifestations of autism. For instance, It has been known for some time that autistic children often have problems interpreting proverbs and metaphors. When asked to get a grip on yourself, the autistic child may literally start grabbing his own body. When asked to explain the meaning of all that glitters is not gold, we have noticed that some high-functioning autistics provide literal answers. It means it's just some yellow metal. Doesn't have to be gold. Although seen in only a subset of autistic children, this difficulty with metaphor cries out for an explanation. There is a branch of cognitive science known as embodied cognition, which holds that human thought is deeply shaped by its interconnection with the body and by the inherent nature of human sensory and motor processes. This view stands in contrast to what we might call the classical view, which dominated cognitive science from the mid through late 20th century, and held that the brain was essentially the same thing as a general-purpose, universal computer that just happened to be connected to a body. While it is possible to overstate the view of embodied cognition, it now has a lot of support. Whole books have been written on the subject. Let me just give you one specific example of an experiment I did in collaboration with Lindsay Obermann and Piotr Winkelmann. We showed that if you bite into a pencil, as if it were a bridle bit, to stretch your mouth into a wide, fake smile, you will have difficulty detecting another person's smile, but not a frown. This is because biting the pencil activates many of the same muscles as a smile, and this floods your brain's mirror neuron system, creating a confusion between action and perception. Certain mirror neurons fire when you make a facial expression and when you observe the same expression on another person's face. The experiment shows that action and perception are much more closely intertwined in the brain than is usually assumed. So, what has this got to do with autism and metaphor? We recently noticed that patients with lesions in the left supramarginal gyrus who have apraxia, an inability to mime skilled voluntary actions, such as stirring a cup of tea or hammering a nail, also have difficulty interpreting action-based metaphors, such as reach for the stars. Since the supramarginal gyrus also has mirror neurons, our evidence suggests that the mirror neuron system in humans is involved not only in interpreting skilled actions, but in understanding action metaphors, and indeed, in other aspects of embodied cognition. Monkeys also have mirror neurons, but for their mirror neurons to play a role in metaphor, monkeys may have to reach a higher level of sophistication, of the kind seen only in humans. The mirror neuron hypothesis also lends insight into autistic language difficulties. Mirror neurons are almost certainly involved when an infant first repeats a sound or word that she hears. It may require internal translation, the mapping of sound patterns onto corresponding motor patterns, and vice versa. There are two ways such a system could be set up. First, as soon as the word is heard, a memory trace of the phonemes, speech sounds, is set up in the auditory cortex. The baby then tries various random utterances, and using error feedback from the memory trace, progressively refines the output to match memory. We all do this when we internally hum a recently heard tune and then sing it out loud, progressively refining the output to match the internal humming. Second, the networks for translating heard sounds into spoken words may have been innately specified through natural selection. In either case, the net result would be a system of neurons with properties of the kind we ascribe to mirror neurons. If the child could, without delay and opportunity for feedback from rehearsal, repeat a phoneme cluster it had just heard for the first time, that would argue for a hardwired translational mechanism. Thus, there is a variety of ways this unique mechanism could be set up. But whatever the mechanism, our results suggest that a flaw in its initial setup might cause the fundamental deficit in autism. Our empirical results with mu wave suppression support this, and also allow us to provide a unitary explanation for an array of seemingly unrelated symptoms. Finally, although the mirror neuron system evolved initially to create an internal model of other people's actions and intentions, in humans, it may have evolved further, turning inward to represent or re-represent one's own mind to itself. A theory of mind is not only useful for intuiting what is happening in the minds of friends, strangers, and enemies, but in the unique case of Homo sapiens, it may also have dramatically increased the insight we have into our own mind's workings. This probably happened during the mental phase transition we underwent just a couple hundred millennia ago, and would have been the dawn of full-fledged self-awareness. If the mirror neuron system underlies theory of mind, and if theory of mind in normal humans is supercharged by being applied inward toward the self, this would explain why autistic individuals find social interaction and strong self-identification so difficult, and why so many autistic children have a hard time correctly